Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
Virtual reality training platforms like ForgeFX allow welding students to learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Have your say on Europe's future at the third edition of the Maastricht debate. We put the candidates in line to lead Europe on stage so you can decide how you want to cast your ballot. More information later on in this episode.
The times of blissful calm are over. We are living in new times, in a pre-war epoch.
If you want peace, prepare for war. Lately, it feels like this old saying is making a comeback. I'm sure Donald Tusk knows it.
Either we undertake the fight to defend our borders, our principles, our citizens, or we will fall.
But the Polish Prime Minister isn't the only one to dampen our spirits as we enter the spring holiday period. Other politicians and diplomats across Europe seem to agree that if Putin isn't outright defeated in Ukraine, things might get messy elsewhere. So to invoke that saying again, we're starting to prepare. But will this new military footing help us keep the peace? Or is it more like sleepwalking into war? I'm Sarah Wheaton, host of EU Confidential. As we listen to dire political statements and hear news stories about how some Europeans worry that war is ever closer, in this episode, we'll try to examine what's driving our sense of insecurity and fueling our growing fear of war. We'll also zoom in on Slovakia to see what's at stake in their presidential election after the first round last weekend and why it matters for the rest of Europe. And finally, because it's Easter, we talk chocolate with my colleague Alessandro Ford. We're going to learn a new vocabulary word, greedflation, which sadly is hitting hard during chocolate egg season this year.
Across Europe, brands and retailers are making hundreds of millions of euros more off our ignorance.
But first, let's welcome my guests. Dialing in from Berlin is Milan Nitsch, Senior Fellow for Central and Eastern Europe at the German Council on Foreign Relations. And joining me in our studio in Brussels is my colleague Barbara Moons, Politico's chief EU correspondent. Milan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Barbara. So you've been on the podcast many times, and we've talked about sort of defense and European preparations or lack thereof to defend itself many times. But usually we're having that defense conversation with our sort of military experts, whereas you're our top reporter checking in on Europe's leaders. Are you getting this sense that we're kind of reaching a tipping point on this discussion about European preparation for war?
I don't think we're at the tipping point yet. That may not come until November with the US elections or, you know, whatever happens on the front line in Ukraine. What we did notice last week when we had the European Council, so all EU heads of state and government flying into Brussels for their regular meetings, was this kind of shift in conversation. You could see it already in the lead up to it with especially French President Emmanuel Macron talking about potential boots on the ground in the future, shifting towards really kind of this sense of urgency to step up when it comes to supporting Ukraine militarily, economically, etc. And that kind of led into that European Council where leaders talked about Ukraine, about defense, about security. And even though there weren't, you know, very concrete decisions, on the contrary, you could even argue, you did feel this sense of unease growing. You normally usually have, you know, countries like the Baltics, and we talked, for example, with the Lithuanian president that openly talks about we need to defeat Russia, right? Not just support Ukraine, but really defeat Russia. And that is a sense and also language that is now being shared by more and more leaders, including European Council President Charles Michel and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Barbara, you just mentioned, you know, Macron's comments that, you know, we shouldn't rule out Western fighters in Ukraine. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk is talking about how we're living in pre-war times. The two of them met with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz recently. Their conversation focused on war, but are they all on the same page about how serious the situation is right now? Milan, what are you hearing in Berlin?
No, they are not on the same page. I think you have now a conversation about what's going on the battlefield, that there is a possibility of Russian breakthrough of the Ukraine defenses around Avdiivka or Bakhmut, because Russians have a big advantage in type of heavy arms and ammunition, and we are not supplying Ukrainians enough. So I always rephrase this conversation about defeating Russia, which is not really in the cards, I think. It's about stopping Russia. And I think there is a sense which I don't feel around that much. And yes, you hear this from Macron and also from Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, is that Russian aims in this war, Putin's aims haven't changed. He wants to crush Ukraine as a state. But if he achieves that, then he dominates half of Europe. This is about the future of the European project. And therefore, I think there is a lot of concern that with the US not supplying Ukraine what they used to, because of blockage in the Congress, Europeans haven't stepped up enough. So I think there should be more focus on things like Czech ammunition initiative, buying ammunition around the world. It needed some conviction with the French to do so. I think what the conversation in Berlin is very much domestic driven. First, it was about Taurus and the leaks. Taurus is so the special technology that would allow Ukrainians to knock out the faraway infrastructure of Russia or strategic things like the bridge to Crimea. By the way, the big success of Ukrainians against the Russian fleet in the Black Sea that allowed them to export grain almost at the level of pre-war was also thanks to the British technology and rockets that were supplied. And the boots on the ground are these that helped them to navigate. So the real concern in Berlin was, but Olaf Scholz responding to Macron sort of made the hints that some of the allies already have boots on the ground, and these are the support or training missions, which wasn't consulted with the allies. So I saw the Weimar Triangle meeting before the European Council also as a damage control.
Yes, definitely. And I think you can also not underestimate the domestic context in both of these countries, right? France, Macron is battling with the rise of the far right, of the Front National. And he has clearly made this war in Ukraine, this discussion topic, a key element of the European election campaign in France. Whereas in that context, he's taking this more hawkish stance than in the past. Whereas in Germany, Scholz is in a very different position in the sense that being more cautious, being more careful, actually helps him on the domestic front. So these Franco-German tensions that we often discuss also happen in these, you know, all politics is local context.
Absolutely. And Scholz faces a new sort of contender in the left-wing camp in the new party of Sahra Wagenknecht that attracts exactly people who feel that maybe Germany is doing already too much and there should be more of attempts to look for a peace solution. So he's trying to cast himself as a chancellor that maybe looks for peace. And his head of the Bundestag fraction, Muzani, famously said that the conflict should be frozen. For 2 weeks, there was a discussion about this, nothing else, which helped Scholz also to go away from the Taurus discussion. I think it's purely domestic politics for Social Democrats. They're trailing behind. And there is European Parliament elections in June, but also then three races at the regional level in Eastern Germany in September where AfD can win.
Maybe just building on that, when you look at the debate at the European level now on how to step up defense spending on the European level, there is this idea of defense bonds, right? That you have common debt for defense spending as we did post-COVID for the recovery fund. And you can sense that the political momentum for that is growing. The country very clearly against that is Germany, and then the Netherlands kind of, you know, hiding behind the Germans. And so you feel that there are these discussions going on now between European diplomats, you know, as with the post-COVID recovery fund, will Germany eventually kind of follow the rest of Europe or not? But at the same time, you have this German domestic political context, which you just described, which makes it very hard to tag along with the countries that have really been pushing for these defense bonds like Estonia, France, Poland.
This conversation is making me think of the expression, if you want peace, prepare for war. Is that the attitude that people have, you know, when you're, Barbara, when you're walking the halls of the European Council, is that what they're saying?
Initially, that was mostly, you know, the concept of the Baltics, Poland, right, that flank of Europe. And you can feel that that sense is really growing, especially also with the Nordic countries. You have frugal countries like Finland and Sweden that would normally immediately bash this idea of defense bonds and now are more cautious about it. You know, we're not there yet, but let's see. Also, Western European countries acknowledging that they have to step up. We recently talked to someone from outside the EU, looking at the intra-EU debate, which is always interesting, focus saying that, you know, these defense bonds, it's a very relevant debate, and obviously it would lead to a lot of military support for Ukraine. At the same time, you have all these European countries, if they would just hit their 2% target for NATO, then the whole debate would be solved in a way when it comes to Europe military spending. And maybe just one more point on that. I did feel a little bit more of a grim sense last week talking to leaders, their entourage, the diplomats in the European Council. Even diplomats saying, you know, how old are your kids? You know, will we really see a time when, you know, we have to think about whether we send our kids to war on the European front? Those are not conversations we had in Brussels a couple of months ago.
Indeed, we are hearing a lot more concern about war really being imminent. Just to invoke again that comment from Tusk about living in pre-war times, we're hearing about a lot of anxiety in Poland right along the border with Ukraine. Milan, you're originally from Slovakia, also a country that shares a border with Ukraine. Are people there as worried as the Poles are about the prospect of war coming?
They are not. Allow me one comment about Donald Tusk. He's facing very important local and regional elections on the 7th of April, and he needs to defeat the peace. And also, I think he's very much aware that we are already in a hybrid war with Russia. There was a rocket that came to Polish airspace, and we see it in disinformation sphere, and also how our, for instance, European elections will be tempered with a lot of structures, with a lot of money there from Russia that are trying to sort of steer our public debates and conversations. Now back to Slovakia. There is not a feeling that we are a frontline country. Yes, this 90-kilometer border with Ukraine is actually bordering Zakarpattia, so the region which was not hit by any rockets, the most peaceful part of Ukraine, which is a place where many rich people from Kiev moved away from the war. What is the governing camp doing now is actually to build up a fear from terrorist attack after the terrorist attack on Moscow, to increase a feeling of insecurity before the presidential runoff. So there will be policemen by the churches during Easter and by shopping malls, because they found out that there is a Tajik citizen in one of the asylum centers in Slovakia and there might be a connection. They completely made it up because it suits the needs of the presidential campaign of Mr. Pellegrini, Speaker of the Parliament. And I think this is a testimony to what is happening around Europe. We have war in Ukraine. We still have war, which will be a long-term war, which is not going away. And Russian President Putin told us that he doesn't want some kind of peace negotiations just because Ukraine doesn't have ammunition. He wants to control the whole country and he wants to be in Kiev, so to speak, and change the map of Europe. And at the same time, our discussion about how to support Ukraine or prepare for a different era is very much influenced by our domestic politics in a fragmented way, in here and then in every country.
Barbara, just to end with you, the corollary of that saying can also potentially be true, that if you prepare for war, the military-industrial complex can just be a self-fulfilling machine.
Yes, exactly. And you hear a lot of diplomats saying, you know, jokingly, not jokingly, that, you know, they've all been reading the famous book Sleepwalkers from Christopher Clark again, how Europe kind of sleepwalked its way into a world war. And that the risk is indeed that, you know, the more weapons you manufacture, the bigger the chances are that they actually get used. At the same time, it feels like, you know, at this point, the EU just doesn't have another option, given that the US is already kind of looking more inwards and potentially even be more the case after the November election, so that Europe really has to step up its game when it comes to supporting Ukraine and defending Ukraine.
All right, we'll leave it there. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us. Milan, stick around until after the break. We're going to pick things back up with you to talk about Slovakia.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
So after the break, I'm going to ask Milan why we should care about who's going to become the next Slovak president, since, I mean, yeah, they don't hold much power. Stay with us. also for our chat on soaring chocolate prices.
The 2024 Maastricht debate is the political moment of the spring for European voters. Now in its third edition, Studio Europa Maastricht and Politico are organizing the debate that will allow you to determine who you want to have as chief policymaker of the European Union. Each contender will represent their own political party on the podium in Maastricht, the birthplace of the 1992 Maastricht Treaty, and will answer questions from our expert moderators on the themes chosen by European youth: climate change, foreign and security policy, and EU democracy. Join fellow European voters on April 29th at 7 p.m. and register to watch the debate live via the link in our show notes. Shape the Europe of tomorrow at the 2024 Maastricht debate. Register today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A message from Meta.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Moving on to Slovakia. I'm going to introduce you to the key characters here, so bear with me for some names. With the current president, Zuzana Čaputová, not standing for re-election, the battle now to become the next president is between the Speaker of the Parliament, that's Peter Pellegrini, and he's an ally of Prime Minister Robert Fico. And then against him is Ivan Korčok. He's a former foreign minister who's seen as more pro-European. They both have different visions for Slovakia's future and its relationship with the EU. Here's my conversation about that with Milan Nič. So, Milan, thanks so much for sticking with us. As we mentioned, you're based in Berlin now, but you are originally from Slovakia. And full disclosure, we're personal friends through your lovely wife. And it's over 10 years ago now, I think, when I visited you when you were living in Bratislava. You're still paying lots of attention to what is happening at home. So catch us up on the election that happened over the weekend. The results were kind of a surprise, right?
The first round was won unexpectedly by Mr. Korčok, the opposition candidate, with 42%, over Peter Pellegrini, the governing coalition candidate, with 37%. The polling were showing exactly the opposite. Korčok's lead was much bigger than expected, so 5% or 120,000 votes. It was the highest turnout ever for the first round in Slovak presidential elections, which is a testimony that the country is very polarized. It's, I think, a reaction to what the Fico government did in less than half a year in office. They really started with a very accelerated legislative push to change the penal code and meddle in the judiciary set up to investigate corruption, because a lot of these government's friends, they were in power. Robert Fico, as prime minister, had to step down in 2018 after the murder of journalist Jan Kuciak and his fiancé, investigative reporter who went after corruption and then was killed by a contracted killer. Robert Fico has a feeling that this police investigation and judiciary involving tens of people at high-level offices is against them. And he wanted to stop it. That was the first thing that interested him. But that generated a backlash, demonstrations at the streets, and it mobilized people for the opposition candidate, Ivan Korčok, former foreign minister, who is not that great campaigner. He is a diplomat, former ambassador to Germany, US, perm rep in Brussels. So the runoff will be on the 6th of April between Ivan Korčok and the Speaker of the Parliament, Peter Pellegrini, who tries to be the moderate in the governing camp, in the coalition of three parties, and somebody who is very much torn apart in between a very radicalized government trying to campaign from a center and sort of as somebody who wants to bring peace and more calm in this a very heated up situation. However, if you look at the candidates on the third places and so on, these are people representing either far right or closer to government coalition. So the reservoir of votes for Peter Pellegrini for the runoff is maybe bigger there. But it will be a new day, a new race, and I think turnout will be the king. Which parts of the country will be mobilized to what extent?
And outside of Slovakia, why should the rest of us kind of care about this race? I mean, the president in Slovakia really mostly just has ceremonial powers.
Yeah, because it's a test of strength between political forces in a very exposed country that has just tilted from the pro-Ukrainian camp to, well, pro-Russian camp, Mr. Fico. And also president has been part of the checks and balances for democracy and rule of law. And this is super important with Mr. Fico, because we went there when he had all the layers of power, including president, before Jan Kuciak was murdered, that was captured state. And now there is war in the neighborhood, directly neighboring country. I think it's important to have a different voice from Slovakia. Also, because Mr. Fico is instrumentalizing domestic politics above everything. So he's an easy, useful idiot for Mr. Orban or for Mr. Putin. And I think a president in the line of Zuzana Čaputová, I think will be important to keep Slovakia anchoring in with the European and NATO partners.
Well, speaking of Orban, there's an interesting angle there. There's a Hungarian minority of about 400,000 people living in Slovakia, and they seem to favor Pellegrini, and not Korczok, who has openly criticized Orban.
Correct, because Mr. Korczok, as a foreign minister, was very critical of Mr. Orban and of Hungarian meddling. He's casted now as anti-Hungarian. And Orban's government and Fidesz party and the state media from Hungary already supported Mr. Fico and his camp in the parliamentary elections back in September. I expect something similar repeated. There was a meeting of Mr. Pellegrini with Mr. Orban. He made an official visit to Budapest just days before the first round of the presidential elections. But in this first round, there was an ethnic Hungarian candidate receiving about 60,000 votes, and I think he will endorse Mr. Pellegrini. And this is a bad omen for Mr. Korczok, because Zuzana Čaputová, when elected 5 years ago, also had a lot of ethnic Hungarian vote.
Also looking at kind of the broader context, you made some references to this earlier. My colleagues Katrin Jochokova and Nicola Camus wrote a piece recently. It was called Slovakia, the EU's Next Rule of Law Headache. Can you tell us a little bit about what is troubling Brussels and what role the new president can play?
Oh, yeah. So there is very controversial legislation that was rushed through a fast-track procedure, the biggest reform of the penal code that basically gives an amnesty on crimes related with corruption or financial crimes. This also involves cases of a misuse of EU funding, which were investigated by the Special Prosecutor's Office. Mr. Fico cancelled this Special Prosecutor's Office because he thought this was a political vendetta against him. So now the European Commission sees this with a lot of concern. Also, there is less clear how high-level corruption will be investigated. And I think the governing camp is underestimating what has shifted in many European capitals in the last few years. There is a lot of sensitivity when you transfer money to cohesion countries that you want to be sure that they are used well, and if there are some missteps, that they are well investigated by the domestic authorities. With the president that is part of the governing camp, you would not have this sort of this role of a president that can question controversial legislation.
Really interesting. Well, the runoffs are 2 weeks away. What are your predictions? I know it's kind of a mean question, but got to ask.
I think it's a very open race. I think it will be difficult for Mr. Pellegrini to convince voters because I don't see him being genuine in this. But maybe the TV debates between the two candidates that were not there before the first round will play an important role.
Of course, we also like to make predictions at the EU level. We want to find any way to read the tea leaves. So what do you think the outcome in Slovakia should tell us about where the political mood is ahead of the European election in June?
If Mr. Korczok, the candidate of the opposition, democratic opposition, so both the liberals that are part of Renew on the EU level and the Christian Democrats that are part of the EPP wins, this is a big momentum for them for the European elections. And vice versa. If Mr. Pellegrini wins and the Mr. Fico's ruling camp have everything, it's a big push for them in the European Parliament elections race. But eventually, these presidential elections is not only about mood for the European Parliament elections next race. It's about the setup for the next few years as democracy is backsliding in Slovakia and rule of law as well.
All right. Milanič, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So, a bit of a warning for anyone observing a Ramadan fast, or maybe those who gave up a particularly luscious indulgence for Lent. Our next segment is all about chocolate. Then again, this is really a trigger warning for everyone, because I come bearing terrible news. Chocolate prices are spiking. To understand how we ended up with these rotten chocolate egg prices, I checked in with Alessandro Ford, a reporter here at Politico who writes about agriculture and food. Alessandro, you have just published an article that really strikes deep at the heart of almost anyone really in the world, especially people buying chocolate here in Europe. Things are getting pretty rough out there at the grocery store. What's going on with chocolate prices?
They're getting super rough, Sarah. So prices have been creeping up for a few years, but this Easter, supermarkets and brands have hiked them up by 50% at times, which doesn't seem much to your average consumer. That means it goes from maybe €2 to €3, or an Easter egg goes from 6 to 7, 6 to 8, 6 to 10 sometimes. But across Europe, that means that brands and retailers are making hundreds of millions of euros more off our ignorance.
Off our ignorance. I mean, I've been hearing all these things about how chocolate might go extinct because of climate change. There are all these shortages. I mean, we're paying for a scarce and necessary resource, right?
It's two things. So yes, there is a shortage. Harvests have been really bad this year. And that means that international prices for cocoa bean have skyrocketed on international markets from about $4,000 at the start of January, $4,000 per ton, to almost $9,000 per ton now, which is the highest amount in half a century. At the same time, because of the way the composition of a chocolate bar works, that shouldn't increase prices by that much. So traders were telling me if it increases by 10, 20% in final retail price, that's acceptable. But when you're talking 50% or more, that's greedflation.
Greedflation. Can you unpack that word a little bit? It makes some sense, but just really spell it out for us.
Sure. So greedflation is when prices increase and there is some sense that it's because of inflation, but actually manufacturers or supermarket chains are pushing prices far beyond the warranted increase from higher input costs. And we've seen that being a problem this year across Europe and across various products. So the French supermarket chain Carrefour got into a big spat with PepsiCo and said, we are no longer going to sell some of their products because they're engaging in greedflation. You've seen the same thing in the UK with baby milk formula. Danone, the French giant, were accused by a UK charity and investigated by the UK regulator for price gouging. And so greedflation can be the simple increase of prices, or it can be shrinkflation, where the price stays the same, but they secretly make the packaging size smaller. Your 100-gram bar goes down to 80 grams and you don't really notice. Or another thing they're doing now is swapping the more expensive cocoa content for cheaper ingredients, so nuts or fruits or vegetable oils.
Okay, so all those fancy chocolate bars with dried fruit that just make it seem extra luxurious, it's actually
cheap.
Oh man, I'm feeling so betrayed right now.
Brave new world we're living in.
Yes. But you spoke to some farmers who are actually growing the cocoa beans. What do they say? And are they guilty of greedflation as well?
They're certainly not guilty of greedflation. They would love to have some greedflation. So for decades now, both the Ivory Coast and Ghana have operated a policy of price controls. There is a set price negotiated by the government with big multinationals, and that price is always around 1,000 Central African francs, which is about €1.50. right now, and that's per kilo of cocoa bean. That means that when prices are down, the farmer is guaranteed an acceptable income. But when prices are skyrocketing, like in the current bonanza, the farmer doesn't see any of it. So I spoke to two farmers specifically, one man near the Liberian border and one man close to the capital in Abidjan. And they both described this horrific existence that is not sustainable. One said, c'est la misère. It's misery. The other just kept repeating to me, cacao is just not profitable. It's not profitable. And that means they're going out of business. Their children don't want to continue in their footsteps. There's no credit. There's no money for fertilizers or pesticides. Climate change is hammering them with intense rainfall, with more pests, because these are giant monocultures. And yes, in the past, you would just slice up rainforest and plant more trees when your output started falling. You can't do that anymore because now the European deforestation regulation is going to penalize producers operating on deforested land, which is a good thing, but they're very concerned and they don't see any way out.
So what does the industry say? Are they acknowledging this greedflation or do they say something else is behind the price increases?
They say that the price increases are driven purely by the supply crunch. They say that regretfully they've had to increase prices, but they're trying to minimize that and not pass on too much to consumers.
This pricing crunch is not only hitting peak Easter egg season, but it's also coming right in the middle of the Belgian presidency of the Council of the EU. And chocolate is kind of the cultural commodity, maybe with beer, of Belgium. So is the presidency planning any sort of policy response to this?
So the Belgian presidency of the council hasn't made chocolate, sadly, a priority of theirs, but it's certainly an economic and a cultural concern. So the chocolate sector accounts for 1% of Belgium's GDP. It's a major export product, accounting, I think, for about 3 to 4 billion a year. And it's a product that's close to people's hearts. I speak to chocolatiers in Brussels, and they tell me that Belgians are born with chocolate in their mouths. In other cultures, you turn up for dinner, you bring a bottle of wine, you bring flowers. In Belgium, you bring chocolate. For every occasion, you bring chocolate. And that means that the industry holds incredible cultural and economic importance.
Is there any way out for consumers, those of us who are rather addicted to chocolate? Are we just going to have to keep shelling out more and more for less and less?
The chocolate industry is relatively concentrated. It's definitely not a monopoly, but there are still about 10 companies that control almost all of the market. And so they've got us in the palm of their hands. There's nowhere else to go, really. There are a few up-and-comers, like Tony's Chocolonely, which always wins the Fair Trade Standards Award. But ultimately, if they're increasing the price, then we're paying it.
All right, well, on that depressing note, Alessandro, thanks for yucking my yum, man.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Thank you for your messages. Do send us more of them at podcast@politico.eu. Also, make sure you follow EU Confidential on your favorite app so you never miss an episode. Thank you to our executive producer, Christina Gonzalez, and to Deanna Sturis, our senior audio producer. I'm Sarah Wheaton. I'm going to be taking next week off. I need some time to scout out the best post-Easter chocolate sales. Only Way can afford it. So we'll see you back here in 2 weeks. Enjoy the break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.